Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. You know, we like to talk about love. Love is love, bonding, how people get together, and all about the experience of love. Well, today I'm going to give you a love story. A love story and something very important, a disease that people don't know about much. We're talking about, you know, you've heard a lot of talk about Alzheimer's disease, and that's one particular thing that happens to people who are older, but there's another form of this which is striking more and more people, and it's called early onset Alzheimer's. At the moment, they don't have a real name for it, but it's but early onset Alzheimer's is a very fascinating thing, and it's because it's so easily confused. And I brought in the studio today, or with me today, is a touching story of a husband's love. My guest is Pat Moffitt, who wrote Ice Cream in the Cupboard. And Pat is a caregiver primarily, but his story and the story of his experience, I think it was going to be very helpful to many people. Pat, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you, Roman. Good to be here.
Yeah. So, Pat, how did this all happen? I mean, let's start with the very story. What happened in Puerto Rico?
Well, we had been, my wife Carmen and I had been kind of bickering, and husband and wife were going to bicker, that's for sure at times, but this seemed to be much more so than I had ever remembered, and every little thing she just seemed to be so upset at. And we both were working, we both had executive positions, and I thought that, you know, we must be under just a little bit too much pressure here.
Well, let's start again. Your wife Carmen, sounds like Carmen might have been from Puerto Rico, was she?
Yes, she was born in Puerto Rico.
Okay, so now she's you're down in Puerto Rico with her. Is it a vacation? Is it a holiday?
No,
are you working?
I felt because of this pressure that we would skip away and have a nice romantic weekend down there where we had been before.
Okay, so this is now, you're in hometown, you're with your wife, she's 53 years old?
53, right.
53 years old, and you're saying, look, we're having a rough time together. Some tension seems to be growing between us. Let's see if we could fix it down here with a little love. Tell me what happened next.
Well, the first night we were there, we went to our favorite restaurant, which is a really nice place. It has a beautiful veranda overlooking the Caribbean Sea, and I was looking, we were having steak and lobster. And I was just looking over the railing from the second floor of this restaurant, and I was just commenting as I was looking that there was the old cars in Puerto Rico, 57 Chevys and 58 Fords, whatever, they last forever because of the climate. Just making a comment, there was no argument or anything going on. And I turned my head back to look at Carmen, and she had picked up the entire plate of steak and lobster and threw it in my face, which knocked me out of the chair onto the floor, and she stormed out of the restaurant. So I pulled myself together and got up and started chasing her, and I caught up to her about two blocks later. Of course, this is a 6'3" Irish guy chasing a 5-foot Puerto Rican woman, and the streets of San Juan isn't a good picture right there. So the police were actually following me. I got her calmed down somewhat and got her into a taxi cab, and she was still very, very agitated, but not making much sense, just yelling. And got back to the room, and she laid down in the bed and went right to sleep. And I went out on the terrace and grabbed myself a can of beer and trying to figure out what just came crashing through my life. What was this behavior about? I just didn't understand it. Maybe she just wanted the marriage to end, and she was trying to irritate me. I just didn't know. So some 15 minutes later, out comes Carmen onto the terrace, and she said, "Honey, I am starved. When are we going to eat?" And I said, "I tried that, and you threw the food at me." And she said, "You know, you always like to joke around with me, but that's not even funny. I would never do something like that to anyone." And so I just kind of froze at that point and really didn't know what to do. But I knew I had to get out of San Juan in a hurry and get back home.
You knew something was wrong. This is Armand DeMille with you. My guest is Pat Moffitt, the name of the book, Ice Cream in the Cupboard. The story of early onset Alzheimer's, and we're talking about something that happens, and specifically happened with Pat, with him and his wife. I mean, here's a man who's in love with somebody, and you know, sometimes you're in a relationship and things start to go wrong. Suddenly your mate turns off to you. Sometimes, you know, she doesn't respond to you the way that she used to, or he doesn't respond. Or there's a little bickering, and you never really know what's going on. You can never be sure. And then in the early 50s, I'm sure, Pat, you heard stories about it. It's possibly menopause or stuff like that, and there must have been a lot of reasons that were brought to your attention. But if you're in love with somebody, you generally try to go through most of the problems. If it means having to go out to dinner at some nice place every now and then, or whatever it is that you need to do to make the relationship work, you make it work. But sometimes it's stacked against you. And this is a story by Pat Moffat about what happened to him. And it started, of course, we were talking about in Puerto Rico, where he was with his wife, and suddenly she had some kind of an outburst, and he wasn't ready for this. So the one thing you did was you got out of Puerto Rico and you came back. And now, what happened from this point on, Pat?
Yeah, I thought it'd be best to get back, at least be closer to the family. And we got the next plane out the following morning. And then over the next several weeks, I began to see more incidents of this, more agitation, forgetfulness. I tried so many times to get it to a doctor, but Carmen wasn't a big doctor visiting person to begin with for anything. So she absolutely refused to go to the doctor.
What kind of forgetfulness did you see? Did you see her having, like, these gaps in reality where she didn't remember what she threw something at you? Or was it just, like, forgetting where she put her keys?
Just forgetting where she put things. There was an incident where she took the dog out, and she was missing for a while. And this was the winter. And about an hour had passed by, and I said, let me go take a walk outside, take a look around. This is unusual to be out in the cold. And she came in just as I was coming out with the dog. And I said, you're crying. And I saw the tears coming down her face. I said, what's wrong? She said, I couldn't find the house. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you're here, so what's to worry? No big deal. And she said, the dog found the house. I didn't find the house. So that was a very big incident, and I started to see more of those things. She was driving the car at that point. I saw her drive by the house five or six times until she found the right driveway. So these things were, you could see these deterioration.
Now this deterioration, but your wife is 53 years old. Everybody would tell you, if you go to anyone and say, what could this be? They would not even think Alzheimer's.
That's correct.
They would. So what did you go through in trying to get to the bottom of this?
Well, I tried to read up on things a little bit on the forgetfulness, short-term memory loss, and I came across the vitamin B12, deficiency of vitamin B12 in women over 50. That creates a short-term memory loss at times. It could be something like that. Menopause certainly was another thought. That certainly women tend to be irritable when that is coming through their lives, and it's attached to short-term memory loss. So what I really was doing there, I was coming up with ideas that were just fueling the denial of what it really was.
Fueling whose denial?
My own. I started to really realize then that this must be something much deeper.
So the denial, and yesterday we did a program about denial. Denial was serving you because you were looking and you're saying, this is more serious.
Right.
But I don't want to face how serious this is.
That's correct.
Because if you face the reality of it, it really means I've lost her.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and that's exactly the way I felt. And then the real straw that broke the camel's back, so to say, was when we went food shopping. We came back, and it's like most women, my wife likes to put away her own groceries. And I went out and did chores. It was on a Saturday. And I came back, and I was going to barbecue that afternoon. And I went into the cupboard, or the pantry, but she always called it a cupboard because she was raised in North Carolina for a part of her life. And I saw this white liquid running down over the other goods. And I pushed the cans aside and pushed the other boxes aside, and sure enough, there was a brick of vanilla ice cream that had deflated and melted in the cupboard. And I said to her, honey, I said, you must have put the groceries away much too fast today. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, you put the ice cream in the cupboard instead of the freezer. And she said, that's exactly what your problem is. You blame me for everything going on in this house, and you never blame those kids upstairs. And I said, there are no kids upstairs. They're married, gone to college. It's just me and you and the dog, remember? And she just refused to answer and walked away. At that point, I knew I was in some really deep trouble. And so the title of the book, Ice Cream in the Cupboard, was really created at that point. That was a pivot.
My guest, Pat Moffat. Pat, I mean, I look at you, I listen to you. I guess you do corporate executive during the day, right?
Yes, I do.
You've also been in the armed forces.
I was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
You're used to taking care of things.
Yes.
So why didn't you just take care of it?
I knew I was...
And I'm saying that with tongue in cheek, because I know you can't take care of it.
Yeah, I knew that after this particular incident, I made that... We have to make a change here. I need some help. If I have to throw a net over her, I have to get her to a doctor. I got to get some examination. Something has to happen. And, well, just coincidentally, I didn't really have to do that at all because she was working in the school system where we live, and her computer that took care of bus passes for the kids in school, all the kids were going in wrong directions. She did the budget administrator. She was a budget administrator. The budget was a complete shambles. There were phone calls coming in where a parent would say, listen, there's nobody home today. I'm coming to pick up my son. Don't put him on the bus. And, of course, Carmen was at the other end of that phone. When she hung up the phone, the call no longer existed. Child goes home on the bus. No one's there. Police are called. Neighbors come over. And everything pointed back to Carmen's desk. So the principal at the school said, told Carmen, listen, there's something going on here. Your work is completely deteriorated, and we think there's something wrong with you, and you really need to go over to the North Shore Health System to have this examination. And if you refuse to do that, we have no choice but to fire you for cause because you're just not doing the job anymore. And she did go for that test, and within a day she was then diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Hmm. What did that feel like?
Well, it was, she came home that day after school, and I had left work early because she said she wanted to talk to me. And when I got home, she sat on the couch and patted the seat next to her for me to sit down there. And she said, honey, I have a touch of Alzheimer's. And I said, that sounds like being almost pregnant. Either you have it or you don't. And she says, well, I do have it. And that was just a crushing blow. It went right through me like a spear.
Because to you, your image of what Alzheimer's was this long degenerative disease that happens to people in their 70s.
Right.
Right? And here you were with your 53-year-old wife, and you knew she was going to be gone.
I did. And
did you feel that, or did you say, okay, we've got to do something about it, because you're a do-something-about-it guy?
Do something about it, guy. But right along with that, she said, well, I've already started to, I'm already in a geriatric clinic, and I've already begun medication. I said, so then you started to ease up a little bit. There was just that slight bit of hope that kind of made you feel you were looking for something to hold on to, and that was good enough for the moment. And then I met with the doctors as we moved along the way and was told that this medicine would slow the progression of the disease, that there was absolutely no cure. What I didn't know was that early onset Alzheimer's it advances 10 times faster in a early onset case than in an elderly case. So Carmen became much worse very fast.
Very fast, like within a year she was much worse?
Within a year, yes, she was. You know, you're really talking about three grades, is mild, moderate, and severe. And she went right through the three grades for the most part. She was severe within 3 years and had to be put in full-time nursing care.
You know, any of you people listening, I know of many of you who, as you get older, you know, you start losing your memory a little bit. And some people think, uh-oh, it must be happening to me. And so Pat's done a lot of research on this as well. He's going to present it to you. Don't get scared, friends. However, do listen up, because, you know, there's a big percentage of our population. Pat, you could join me in this conversation. I think we heard someone on Majid Ali's show say between 10 and 15% of our population now is over 60.
Right.
And 10% of them are candidates for Alzheimer's. How many people currently are there that may have Alzheimer's or do have Alzheimer's, according to your statistics?
4.5 million in the United States.
4.5 million people,
right,
who are suffering this problem, and therefore families who are suffering with them. And you were saying more about the statistic, 10% of which?
Yeah, 10% of that 4.5 million are early onset, and that's the under 65 category. That's 450,000 people with early onset Alzheimer's. That's a frightening number. It's not 5,000 or 6,000 spread across the country. It is in that number, and that, those statistics are well kept.
Now, you're not, as I said, you're not used to being helpless. And I think one of the greatest difficulties you have when you love someone who is not well is feeling powerless. You want the doctors to cure them. You want the hospitals to cure them. You want your research to cure them. You might have even gone to religion to try to, you know, find some kind of hope. But it would, what happened in your heart? What happened to you?
Well, there wasn't anything I could do, and I tried to come up with all kinds of ideas. What could I do to at least improve her quality of life? I'm often asked, is there anything else that you would have done differently? And the answer to that is yes, I would have taken a leave of absence from work, and I would have tried to do everything that we always planned to do when we were going to retire. I didn't understand the acceleration and how fast that was, because nobody really knew. The accelerations are at different levels for different ages at times. But I always call them the notch in the Alzheimer's gun. In one case, we loved the Broadway theater. Being New Yorkers, I can go to a 75-seat theater downtown. I can go to the big shows uptown, but Carmen and I love the theater. And we went to see Titanic right in the middle of all this some years ago. And it was a very high-energy play where there, you know, a ship is sinking, but they got to do this on the stage, so furniture is flying all over the place. And it was an excellent, well-done play. And we walked out. Outside, and we're crossing 46th Street, still within the shadow of the marquee, and Carmen said, you know, honey, one of these days we've got to go together and go to a Broadway show.
Yeah.
So I knew it was another notch in the gun of Alzheimer's.
What happens to love and affection? What happens to you're laying in bed with somebody you love, and pardon me for getting so personal, but it's the kind of things they wouldn't discuss. What happens to romance, love, affection? Is it, does she have any, first of all, does she... Did she lose her connection to you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's no feelings. I try to tell people that I work with this disease that are caregivers, have as many laughs as you can because they disappear quickly. The loving kind of things and the laughs where you can have a good chuckle together, they just die. The feelings are not there. They just don't exist. They fade away as you're fading away.
So you have no affection then?
She has no affection.
But you have no affection coming from her.
Correct.
Do you still, does she still respond to the warmth of your touch?
Yes, you know, just a hug, a kiss goodnight. That was pretty much the, that was the
extent of it. Sex
yeah.
was out of the question?
Absolutely.
How would that be responded? I mean, would she just say, stay away from me, or she would get angry?
That would create violent outbursts.
Let's talk about violence, mm-hmm. Okay. Violent outbursts. You know, I mean, there are more cases I know of men who have been assaulted by women with violent outbursts than people know about. We know about the women who get assaulted by men. But when a woman assaults a man, very often that man won't go anywhere to, you know, to tell somebody about it or show it. But in the case where you have a mate, and that mate has Alzheimer's or early Alzheimer's, there's a high incidence of violence. Now let's talk specifically about what you call violence. Throwing a plate of lobster at you, that doesn't border on violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a violent act. But how violent did she get?
Violent to the point that one particular incident is probably as bad as it got. She 10 o'clock, she just got up off the couch and was walking out the door. So I'm going out. See you later. And I said, honey, you can't go out. It's cold. It's late. You know, you just can't do that. Don't tell me what I can do. I'm going out. So I said, no, you're not. She moved herself to the door, and I went to grab her to pull her back. And she punched me in the face and then continued punching me on the top of my head. I just ducked. Because one time before that, I tried to hold her in place. It was a dumb thing to do because it just made her worse. So now I ducked, and I said, please don't hit me. I love you. You should not hit me. And she immediately stopped and said, I would never hit you. I love you. Why would I do that? So it didn't even exist. But heavy-duty punching, smacking, that was what we were really talking about.
And I want you to understand that you're talking to Pat Moffitt, who's no small guy. So, you know, you have somebody hauling off and whacking at him, and there must be a tendency on your part to either slap her, you know, hold her in place, do something. Now, you're saying among the things you recognize you should never do is try to confine them? Because I remember, I know cases of people who had who had shadow Alzheimer's, where they would feel like they had to go out or they had to go somewhere, and you were told prevent them from going out because, you know, they were just going to go out into the streets.
Right.
How do you set boundaries when you don't want to hold a person in place? What have you done?
What I really tried to do is to create distractions. You know,
okay.
We love to play 500 Rummy, you know. So I got to the point that when she did that again, I went, you know, why don't we both go out later, but right now, why don't we just sit down and have a game of 500 Rummy, which she no longer could remember how to play. But I played her both hands for us, and it distracted her. So I would come up with different distractions. I want to take a look at those dresses you have in the closet. Maybe we should take a look at those and pick one out for this weekend. So things like that have been distracting, and that seemed to go away, and that would be it for the rest of the evening.
How long was her attention span in general? How much attention span was there? I mean, was she generally, if she got into a violent mood or an episode that was something that showed you she was completely lost, how long might that last?
5 seconds, 10 seconds.
Really?
Yeah.
And you learned.
And you learned from that.
Pat, you know, the things I've heard about the real victims, I mean, not only the real victims, but the additional victims are the families. Families of people with Alzheimer's and early onset Alzheimer's is terrible. Now, she had two daughters. She had three daughters of her own before you met her.
Correct.
And they see you. They're trying to tell you how to handle her. Now, when you're young and you're in your 20s and you see a man with your mother trying to help your mother and trying to do things, and you finally put her in a nursing home, how did they feel towards you?
They were very angry. They felt that I could easily just quit my job and stay home with her, and that I could keep this completely under control. When, in fact, the doctors that told me that she had to be put into the full-time nursing care were very clear on the point that you're just wasting your time because she needs this full care. If she has a convulsion of some sort, these antipsychotic medications that she was on, they can last for 2 weeks or a year. But no one really knows when they stop, and something may cause them to stop, such as a convulsion or a bad reaction to the medication. So the doctor said, you know, if you do that, you're just wasting your time. You just can't do that. So the three girls really accused me of throwing their mother away, and because I want to just move on with my life and not be bothered.
And so those three got alienated, but you also had two children with her, right?
Right, two boys that were always a big help to me and would try to spell me when they could. But the younger boy had a fear of being alone with her, so it was really one son that gave me most of the help.
And so you would be there. Now, you had to get depressed. I mean, you had to burn out from this, because I can imagine a guy like you, who's taking care of everything, now you're powerless. And powerlessness, to certain guys, is a very difficult feeling and recognition. Now you're powerless, and you're trying desperately to do things. What happened to you? I mean, what happened to your mood, and how did you finally gather yourself? Because from what I could imagine, and as I see most families, the husbands and wives of people with Alzheimer's and the children of people with Alzheimer's suffer enormously, and nobody considers them as much as they consider the person who's got the Alzheimer's. But sometimes the toll is even greater on the families with suicides and depressions that... Tell me
yeah,
what
truly.
You know about it.
Well, she was in the Alzheimer's Daycare Center, and the violent behavior that she was having, she was with elderly patients that she was knocking over, and they said, you know, you have to go through this psychotic drug testing, which she did. But what the doctors told me was that in about 3 weeks, the test will be completed, and we're going to give you a much calmer wife to take home. And then, of course, as it turned out, they said the case is too severe, and that would be the end of it. But during that period of time while I had her in the Alzheimer's Center, I was getting up at 4 a.m, bathing her, trying to do her hair, put some makeup on, try to make her look, dress her, pick out the right clothes, go to work, drop her at the Alzheimer's Center, go to the office, work for 7 or 8 hours, come back, pick her up. Of course, the bank account depleted because this was an expensive thing, but I was keeping her at home, and I was yet trying to maintain my job. From all this, the doctor said, you know, you're done. You've lost weight. Your blood pressure is skyrocketing. You have bags under your eyes, so we know you're not sleeping. As we've been watching your wife, we've also been watching you, because this disease can take two victims, the caregiver and the patient. And that's when I had to go into therapy myself.
What was the focus of the therapy? What did it do?
Focus of the therapy was medications, antidepressants, all day long.
For you?
Yes, and I was by far a pill-taking kind of person. I had to get into a regimen this because I would slump at any time and just break down into tears. I could be just driving home from work and have a complete breakdown and I had to pull off the road.
Something you were used to doing in your
not
life.
Not at all. Not at all. And, you know, stayed with that. And then as time went on, you know, I wanted to do something more for this disease. What could I do to fight this disease? And so ice cream in the cupboard was my offering as a tribute to my wife for getting this disease and then working with the people that I work with today.
When the book came to my attention, Ice Cream in the Cupboard by Pat Moffitt, Moffett, I looked at it and looked at the color, and I got the idea of it, you know, the idea of what it's like to love someone or care for someone who you lose, but they're still there. And the cost of it to you, that you have no time for anything else except to be there, it's quite a remarkable thing. We're going to talk much more about this as we continue our hour. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're with Pat Moffitt. There are some of the symptoms, the early stages of Alzheimer's are sometimes very subtle, and they resemble signs that people attribute to natural aging, like repeating statements. People repeat statements. People misplace items. They have trouble finding names for familiar objects. They get lost on familiar routes. They have personality changes. Now, these are things that could happen just about everyone to everyone. But sometimes you have to pay a little additional attention, as Pat did when he was trying to look at this. And when we get back, Pat's got some statistics about this early Alzheimer's that I think will be very, very valuable for us. So we're going to go through it, and this is a... Part of the one just final thing, I want to talk about the medications, Pat, and I know that it's probably going to have somebody steamed at me for saying it, but I haven't heard of a medication that does any good for anybody with Alzheimer's except pound them over the head and make them less violent because it puts them in a stupor. You know, those antipsychotics. I mean, what do you know about, what worked with your wife? Because you don't know anything about the medicine, But what about what worked with her? I mean, they gave her antipsychotics.
The antipsychotics was just the purpose of calming her down. That's all that did. It stopped the violent tendencies. Even though she takes those medications today, when I visit her on a Sunday to bring some fruit up into the nursing home, she'll occasionally take a swing at me still with that. So that's as much as I know about them. That's all they were designed for, to do nothing more to the disease itself. This is cutting down a symptom.
And they think it's mainly to make a person manageable. You know, even in the nursing home,
right,
they can't keep her manageable until they give her a medication.
Well, the interesting part of that, too, that you hit that right on the head, because nursing homes throughout the country now will not take a dementia patient without going through the psychotic drug testing.
Oh, no.
So they don't have the people to handle it. They were going to be dealing with 10 patients that where Carmen would be running all over the place and getting out of the building. They'd never be able to control them, and they'd probably hurt them more than help them. So you have to go through that antipsychotic drug testing, and it has to be prescribed for that patient before they'll say yes.
So you mean it's kind of like automatically we're going to give you an antipsychotic if we're going to put you in a house?
Pretty much.
I wonder what drug company engineered that one. You know, it sounds like the work of one of the great drug companies. You know, hey, why don't we just make it a requirement? Because they might have thought of something else to do, like bingo. But we'll come back. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I'm going to take a short break. I'm going to play you some very sensitive music. And then we will continue with Pat Moffitt, author of Ice Cream in the Cupboard. Beautiful music. Concerto de Arañez. You know, it reminds me. It's such a sensitive piece, and it reminds me. It reminds me of some of the pains and beauty of being in love with someone. And part of what we see, you know, when you love someone is like it's a dedication. You go through so many tough places, and, you know, you seem like physical changes get in your way, and illness and stuff gets in your way, or mood shifts or changes. And you somehow, if you have the right stuff, you can maintain a commitment. You can maintain a love. And if somebody gets ill and something happens to someone, you try to take care of them, which is what Pat Moffat did. Pat Moffat, who's sharing with us the story of his wife and the story of her early onset Alzheimer's. You know, it's part of, I think, what most people, Pat, are not prepared for. Young people get married, 20s and 30s, and they're there, you know, and they say, oh, this is it, it's good. It's fun, it's wonderful, you know, oops, something broke. All right, well, you'll take care of it, all right, or we'll take care of it, or you got something broken, we'll take you to a doctor, right? Oh, something else broke. Okay, you got a cold, we'll take care of you, you got a fever, we'll take care of you. But then gets this point where something is so broken, and you're there, and not only can't you take care of it, but you're dealing with the fact that the person who you're trying to take care of doesn't even recognize you. So now tell me about your travels around the world to try to find some kind of an answer to this.
Well, it was really the travels around the world, whereas my job takes me, my day job as an executive. And I had been in China just in November. Of course, I've been dealing with the whole Alzheimer's subject for some 10 years now, and was completely shocked to learn that they think they have somewhere between 6 million and 12 million cases in China. They're not sure which. They don't keep very good records. But one thing that I did learn that in China, as in some other countries as well in Africa, that this disease is looked at as a stigma to a family. So in China, out in the Western regions, the first point is the doctors are not trained to diagnose Alzheimer's to begin with. So, but the families keep the patients hidden, so they have to find the patient before they could diagnose them to begin with. And let's take a look at why with this stigma. If there's a family that's in businesses, they don't want their business partners or their customers to find out about this. That could be bad for business. It could put them out of business if they have this strange disease. Marital relations between families. If the family of the groom or the bride finds that the other family has Alzheimer's running in it, there's a huge fear that that strain is going to run through the marriage and into their children at some point later on. So it's a very difficult situation there. There's not enough places to treat these people by far, not even Beijing and Shanghai where there are a lot of cases. And then they hide it, where patients are almost locked in a room if the caregiver has to go out for some period of time so no one sees them and they don't get out loose on the street on their own. Completely opposite from what we're doing in the United States because we're putting so much of a huge effort into this. Doctors are always working on it. They're always doing the best they can. Big Pharma is pouring it on as much as they can. But in China, the Olympics is probably more important.
Most of the treatment, you know, that goes towards trying to help the people, look at what we've got for treatment. We're going to put them in homes, right? And then we're going to give them antipsychotic medication. I mean, what kind of treatment is that? There's no treatment. It's just management. And then the treatment of the family is to get you to understand it's not your fault and for you to feel less powerless. But there is no treatment. There's nothing going on. There's nothing really happening unless you've found something to the contrary, have you?
No, I haven't. Only that the medications that are out there and the ones that are planned. I think that when we look at, you know, some of the medications and what's going on there, there are 500 drugs worldwide right now in trials. 70 to 100 of them are in the United States. that are in trials. There are 9 drugs here that are in phase 3, which is the last approval for the FDA. We could see something like that maybe in another year. They could be approved. Once again, though, they're only designed to slow the disease down. There is no cure here at all. And then the worst statistic out of all of those is 95% of all these drugs that are presented fail in the first place.
They fail because even though it's an approved medication, they're saying this medication works sometimes with some people.
Well, not only that, it works sometimes with some people, but in places where they don't have an FDA, they have a case that says, well, look at this. This is doing wonderful. I think we can cure Alzheimer's disease with that. And the entire bunch of patients die of liver disease. So it creates another disease and kills them, and they still have the Alzheimer's to begin with. That's what I mean about that, why we have to go through that. And I'm glad we do have some kind of an FDA, you know, to have a net and to make sure that all the bases have been covered.
I've heard some nutritionists recently talking about how their nutritional approach really is very, very effective, but I haven't seen anything to the effect yet where it just is one big question. How do you love somebody who's out of control, who can't be safe with themselves unless you turn over your life and you're with them every minute? How do you care for somebody? Is it that you care for them, or you medicate them, or you get them a little prefrontal lobotomy? I am surprised that people aren't at this point doing something like saying, let's do some disconnecting in the brain. Let's do some surgery to at least get the person from not hurting themselves. Not that I'm in favor of it, but it's a lot better than what I consider some of the inhuman treatment of putting somebody in a nursing home, giving them an antipsychotic drug, and saying to them, here, vegetate. Because that person's not getting the pleasure of the environment, even if it's in a wealthy, good environment. They're not home.
No, but the as you mentioned, the surgery part, this, of course, the what's happened into the brain with onset with Alzheimer's is it's a beta amyloid protein, and the protein is kind of a sticky, gooey sort of substance that we all manufacture somewhat in as a, just the human without Alzheimer's. The Alzheimer's patient just generates it, manufactures it, and what that does is it grabs onto the memory cells and kills them. And so surgery to try to clear this up is just really not an option at this stage.
And they found no way of defeating this substance that's killing the memory cells.
No, but that is the direction. The whole idea being, if we can slow down the production of the beta amyloid protein, we can do better with Alzheimer's.
Hmm. And what do you find? I mean, what are you finding at this point? Now, here you are. You wrote a beautiful book to help people out, you know, which is about just like giving them the kind of support, ice cream in the cupboard. Would you, Pat, at this point, would you form another relationship with someone else?
I think that's okay to do that, yeah. I think that you have to move on with your wife. That's one of the things that the therapist told me right up front, that, listen, I can give you these pills all day, you can take them all the time, and that's fine. He said, but unless you do something for yourself, whatever that may be, whatever makes you happy in your life, and everybody needs somebody. And so, yes, I think that's fine to do.
So you think that is, even though you're committed by a marriage to someone who is now virtually gone, like somehow you got to take care of yourself. Somehow you're thinking if you're moving on to another relationship, I don't think you could get active divorce in those cases.
You can get a divorce rather easily, actually, but I would never do that. That's something I wouldn't do.
Well, explain that to me.
It's just a feeling that I have. It's the last attachment we have to each other, even though she doesn't know me anymore.
So I'm dedicated to you. I may love someone else.
Right.
I may have a romance with someone else,
right,
but I'm totally dedicated to you.
Correct.
People are going to find that so hard to believe, and yet on the inside, I am sure it's a wonderful thing to be able to go through. Because I've known so many people who have just suffered. It's like they had to give up their lives because their partners were gone, you know? And it's not the idea, especially you have children, right? Because
right,
it had an impact on them as well.
Sure. And of course, my wife hasn't known me or who I am, even when I go to the nursing home every week. Doesn't know who I am and hasn't known me in many, many years. Of course, I wouldn't take up with another relationship if that weren't the case. That would be awful. But this is death in itself in another form.
So she's kind of there, but not there.
Correct.
In effect, your wife died already.
In my view, yes.
And her
a long
body.
Time ago.
Well, now, that's a funny thing because, you know, I think that's true. I think that happens with a lot of people when they get to the nursing home, that they have, in effect, their spirit or their soul has kind of died and or left, you know, and what's left is the shell of a person. So now here comes a question. If you have a mate who's got that kind of illness and is put away in a place where, you know, she's just medicated and living out her days, you have not really had a chance to go through a thorough grieving process because it's her body is still there. The grief is the piece that I think the mates need to go through. And I imagine that one of the things that therapists miss when doing treatment for the mates who are the caregivers is they have to help them grieve. But the problem with helping somebody grieve is then they would almost be saying, I separate from you. You know, it's almost like saying you must separate from this person and continue your life and still take care of them till their dying days if you want to. But I think in order to do that, you have to allow yourself to feel the grief. The grief is the loss and the anger and all the other things that you go through at that time.
My feeling on that is the grieving is perpetual when you have an Alzheimer's situation. I grieve every week. When a person loses a loved one that completely passes away, yes, you're grieving, but you're starting somewhere else, and that grief will lighten as the years go by. For me, it's brand new every week. It doesn't stop for me, and it never will. Until Carmen passes away from this world, that's when the grieving will finally start coming to a close years after that.
Well, in a way, Pat, let me ask you, do you wish that Carmen would die soon?
I really do. This is, knowing my Carmen, she would never want to be on the earth like this, where a person just has, they've lost all their personality and integrity, and you know, they have nothing.
The dignity.
Dignity. She would never want to be seen like that. And I just know that this is not something that she would want. Carmen signed a non-resuscitate document 10 years before she got Alzheimer's. She wanted to make sure this was clear way ahead of time. Don't you keep me around. If I'm very ill and they're just going to keep me with tubes, there is no way in the world. And I think that's what she would want at this moment as well.
So there's a tough one. You know, I mean, in a way, you want to take care of her. You wish for her sake that she would die. You know, I know of a case recently where a man had Alzheimer's, and he fell and hurt his head, and he got some big thing on his head, some kind of a swelling that turned into some kind of a tumor on his head, and the surgeon said, we're going to operate on it, and the wife said, don't operate on it. Leave it alone. They said, but it'll kill him. And she said, leave him alone. You know?
Yeah.
Let him go.
There's a case in California right now that I'm working pretty close with. It's a young lady who had the caregiver of the year for California. She's a 14-year-old girl and does some acting. And I try to work with these families. Her father was 50 when he got it. He was a fairly big guy, had tried to really choke her to death twice. And I met her and signed a book for her when she got the award. And she said, Mr. Moffitt, she said, if my mother wasn't in the room, you and I wouldn't have been having this conversation. So that's how close these things come. But now as I've spoke with that family, and I just to check in and see how they're doing, the mother has told me that the father has now stopped eating. His mouth is clenched closed. So it's now coming to the time of the feeding tube. So, of course, his family on that side is saying, well, put the feeding tube in. But that's going to bedridden him. And that's not a panacea either necessarily, because they fall out, they tear out. And then on the other side, if you don't do it, he starves to death. So, you know, I said to this woman, you're going to have a tough time because half of this crowd is going to turn against you, that's for sure, no matter what you do. But you need to make that decision yourself. You and your daughter have to come to grips with it and say, no matter what, this is what we're going to do because we think this is what Dad would want. When you're in starvation in these kind of cases, you're not holding a cheeseburger in front of someone saying, you're hungry and you can't have this. The starvation of the mind has already taken place because the Alzheimer's has just completely destroyed it anyway. So
I've seen many cases where somebody's ill and they could be dying from even an old age syndrome, you know, just things falling apart, where families have decided that, you know, the starvation is the only way to go. It's almost like we are forced, and this is a dreadful subject, we are forced into a kind of a passive euthanasia because we have no way in our society of pulling a plug. You know, we have no way. And it's like, if it were you, what would you want? If this were you, Pat, if you were the person and your family were there, would you write them a note now and say, if I ever get Alzheimer's where I can't recognize you when you come to see me, what would you say to them?
The answer is the same. I'd want it for me as well.
You'd want what?
Yeah. I would not want feeding tubes to keep me alive when I have no idea who I am, where I am, or who anybody is around me.
Pull the plug.
Please do.
Please do. But now that we have a problem, because here we have a whole bunch of people who are wishing for the sake of the person they love that that person would suffer. Well, here's a question. Now, wait, there's an argument here. Does the person with Alzheimer's suffering? Is your wife suffering?
Not really, no.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Mine is gone, but her blood sugar is perfect. Her cholesterol is perfect. She has no muscle problems. She has trouble walking. She has to get around in the wheelchair sort of now. But pain, no, there's no pain. Per se.
And how is, I mean, I have a neighbor who's got Alzheimer's, and he's like, every now and then I see him and I look at him, he looks at me blankly like he doesn't recognize me. And from what I'm told, he wears diapers and he doesn't have somebody taking care of him. But he's not unhappy.
Right.
So now, if they're not unhappy and they're not in pain, and yet we know that their existence is just existence, but they're not unhappy and they're not in pain, yet we wish they would kind of pass on for their own sake or for our sake. I mean, it's really for your sake that you wish you would pass on, because she could live that way in a community of people just like her forever. She's just not there. You just have no way of separating with her.
That's right. That's right. But it's still something that I believe in, knowing her and what she would want that's where I see the.
I just wish there were an alternative. I wish there were a place, because you know, very often I see Alzheimer's, and I may be doing this very amateurishly. I see Alzheimer's as a return to infancy. I see somehow that it's kind of a way that a person gets to a certain point and then the mind returns them back all the way back in time as they become more and more infant-like, as they become more and more dependent. And it bothers me that there's not a place where people could be together like this and really truly be together with enjoyment and have some enjoyment as opposed to just biding their time. How about pets? Has anybody explored the idea of what it's like to have pets?
We had a pet, and I thought, which was Carmen's dog, was found out on a highway at the Garden State Parkway with a broken leg by her sister, and she gave it to Carmen, and Carmen nursed it back. And after Carmen was in the nursing home, the dog's name was Rainy, and I said, you know what, I think I'll pick her up, and I got permission from the nursing home to bring the dog up. Because you could carry the dog. It's a Cocker Spaniel. And I walked up, and there was no reaction to the dog at all. And that was in the earlier time, not recently.
So I wonder what it would be like if somehow there was visitations, as there were with some elderly, if people bring pets just so that they can have a contact, you know, that the people could have contact, whether they recognize the dog or not, or recognize the cat themselves, just to have some kind of comfort. Well, you know, I'm doing all the things that so many people do when they're faced with their powerlessness about what to do to help people like this. And, you know, Pat, I think you've written a wonderful book, Ice Cream in the Cupboard, by Pat Moffat. I think it's wonderful because I think it really gives the caretaker some understanding of what it's like to go through this and to go through it successfully as opposed to going through it in a frustrated, crazy kind of way, as many people do. And I'm glad you and your children were able to pay attention and survive, and I'm glad there are a few people who could pick up this book and say, well, in the name of Carmen, you know, we at least thank you. You know, thank you, because it's such a difference. It's made such a difference to all of us. I want to thank you for being with us today, you know.
Thank you, Armin. Very good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come by.
Yeah, maybe we may have to do this again, because I think there's going to be a time when we're going to want to maybe have questions with people.
Well, anytime I'm needed, this is the contribution back into what I'm trying to do for Alzheimer's, speaking to your audience, writing a book. I do guest speaking around the country in different places. All that's, is my contribution back to like I can do for the disease and someday help end it.
And if people want to, of course, they can get your book, Ice Cream in the Cupboard, and they could go to your website as well, which is called?
PatMoffitt.com.
PatMoffitt.com. If people wanted to get more information, if they wanted help, isn't the Alzheimer's Foundation, where would they find it on the web?
It's ALZ.org.
ALZ.org, yeah. And then you just put in a zip code, and they tell you all of the available facilities and that which is available.
Yes, that's
for
the Alzheimer's Association website, and that's worldwide, actually. So.
And what about in Long Island? There's one.
Long Island, we have the Long Island Alzheimer's Foundation that is separate from that, but all out for the same thing, of course.
All right, and just I'm going to play the next piece, which I'm going to play right now. Our outro music is for Carmen. Hey, friends, this is Armand DeMille. I'll be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. with more of this programming. If you want to listen to today's program or get a copy of it, you can go to thepositivemind.com or you can go to WBAI.org. The program will be online within hours. Thanks very much again, Pat Moffitt, Ice Cream in the Cupboard, and thanks to all of you. Bye-bye for now.
This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and on the web at WBAI.org. Thank you very, very much, Armand DeMille, for sharing the last hour with all of us. And Pat, this is for you.
And all its edges folded and the corners faded, sepia brown. And yet it's all I have of our past love. A postscript to its ending. Brighter days, I can see such brighter days, when every song we sang is sung again. And now we know this time it's for good. And we're lovers once again. And you're near.